shell off. My money stacked fat, plus I can't turn the swell off. The franchise doing big business. I live this, it's automatic. I win this, so you hear those horns, you finished. A soldier, and I stay under you fighting. Plus I'm storming on you chumps like I'm thunder and lightning. Ain't no way you breaking me, kid. I'm harder than nails. Plus I keep it on lock like I'm part of the jail. I'm slaughtering stale competition. I got the whole block wishing they could run with my division, but they gone fishing with no bait. Kid, your boy, hold weight. I got my soul straight. I brush your mouth like Colgate. In any weather, I'm never better. Your boy's so hot, you'll never catch me in the next man's sweater. If they hate, let them hate. I drop your whole clan. Lay your ass down for the 3 second tan.
Your time is up, my time is now. You can't see me, my time is now. It's the franchise where I'm shining now. You can't see me, yeah. My time is now.
It's gonna be what it's gonna be. 5 pounds of courage, buddy, base, 10 pants with a gold tee. It's a war dance, a victory step. A raw stance is a gift, and you insist it's my rep. John Cena trademark, y'all are so-so. And talk about the bread you make, but don't know the recipe for dough, though. Aiming guns in all your photos, that's a no-no. In this pop, your lip lock, your big talks are blatant no-so. See what happens when the ice age melts. It seems monetary status is not what matters, but it helps. I'm rocking timepiece by Benny, if any. The same reason y'all could love me is the same reason y'all condemn me. A man's measured by the way that he thinks. Not clothing lines, ice links, leather and minks. I spent 20 plus years seeking knowledge of self. So for now, Mark Breck is living life for wealth.
Your time is up, my time is now. You can't see me, my time is now. It's the franchise where I'm shining now. You can't see me, my time is now. Your time is up, my time is now.
What is up, KHTX listeners? This is Chris Roberts with another edition on Thursday, October 6th of The Elephant in the Room. God, that was choppy. Anyway, a few announcements first before we get the show started. It is my brother's birthday, so happy birthday to him. We should be getting awesome weather soon, unless you're in South Florida. But up here, we should be getting some pretty awesome weather. Speaking of South Florida, man, they're even covering that thing on CNBC like crazy. Dang, business networks even going, you know, it's really funny to hear him talk about it, though, on like CNBC. That's what I was watching before this, is they're talking about, you know, what is the economic impact of this storm? I mean, they're asking all these people who are like trying to prepare and save lives and all these things. And they're like, you know, they're trying to save lives. Like, no, I need you to tell me, what do you think the economic, and half people are like, I can't believe you're even thinking of that right now. Like, people are getting mad at people on CNBC. It's like, you came on to CNBC. Anyway. So today's show, I got a really big piece here that I'm going to split into two about this deal in Colombia. Obviously, Kim Kardashian throwing a PR stunt at us. Really throwing a PR stunt at us. Kind of squashes some stories. But you may have heard about this peace referendum thing going on in Colombia. And I'm going to give a full workup of what's going on, because I personally think it's really important. It's a great piece of history on a South American country. Anyway, then we're going to talk about the Manhattan housing market, because I know that's so relevant to all of us, but it's still a good story. And then, you know, I'll give you a few comments on that VP debate we had happen a couple nights ago. Tell you what I thought about it. And I will say this, I do have less harsh things to say about both candidates than I did about the presidential debate. Ironically, they both seemed more presidential than their counterparts who were actually running for the office. Anyway, going to go ahead and play a little bit more music here, and then when I come back, I will get you going with the failed peace deal in Colombia. What's up, KHTX listeners? Once again, this is the elephant in the room. And I said right before the break that I was going to talk about the situation in Colombia. Really don't know how else to describe it. But so some of us may have seen the headlines recently, though, regarding a failed peace deal within the country of Colombia. You may have also scratched your head wondering what in the world happened to Colombia, or, well, what didn't happen to Colombia. Anyway, well, to put it short, the FARC rebels, and I'll get to them at the next part of this little tidbit, FARC rebels and the recognized Colombian government failed to reach enough votes on a referendum that would have essentially assured a peace between the two groups. Now, that headline probably generates more questions than answers, so here's a nice little summary of what has happened and why. Firstly, I'll get to the referendum. Essentially, a vote was cast in Colombia for a peace deal that brought both President Juan Manuel Santos and the FARC leader, leader Temolian Jimenez, he also goes by a weird pseudonym, but that they had signed. The deal took 4 years to negotiate and has been quite the controversy in Colombia. The day before the vote, it seemed that the yes or peace votes would win, but on voting day, the no votes won by a 50.2% to a 49.8% margin. That is a margin fewer than 54,000 votes out of a 13 million vote contest. Turnout was pretty dismal at 38%. Interestingly, but for good reason, the perimeter countries, counties in Colombia voted yes, while the interior voted a resounding no. The rebels have been in conflict the most in the border counties. Especially those in the west where civilian deaths are not uncommon. So why did those in the central part of the country vote no? Well, for one, they are more isolated to the conflict, and the population of central Colombia is much more urban than the border counties, which are very rural. Supporters of the no campaign had good reason to vote no, at least in their minds. The BBC says that under the agreement, special courts would have been created to try the crimes committed during the conflict. Those who confessed to their crimes would have been given more lenient sentences and would have avoided serving any time in conventional prisons. So why was this such a big problem for some citizens? Well, they also balked at the government's plan to pay demobilized FARC rebels a monthly stipend and to offer those wanting to start a business financial help. Other no voters simply didn't trust they'd lay down their arms and cited failed peace agreements as evidence, the last one occurring, I believe, in 2006. Lastly, some were displeased that the FARC would receive 10 seats in the Colombian Congress because it gave them an unfair advantage. They feel as though they didn't win those seats, and so therefore they felt that was an unfair advantage. They never formed a party. They were just, you know, we'll get on more later to who the FARC is. This is just important to understand the whole situation. Both the president of Colombia and the FARC leader, Tomachenko, that was his weird name, have said they are committed to continuing to work toward a peace and that the ceasefire would stay in place. The no-voting Congress members and former President Alvaro Uribe said that corrections must be made on the deal. Also from the BBC, it says that the corrections that he has demanded are among others, that those found guilty of crimes be barred from running for public office, that FARC leaders serve time in prison for crimes committed, that the FARC use their illicit gains to pay their victims' compensation, and that no changes be made to the Colombian Constitution, i.e. there will not be a new party. It's sad they couldn't reach a deal, but what I am happy for is that the country of Colombia can finally come together and have a righteous, pluralistic vote. The country has made strides in the right direction over the last decade, and I hope they reach a peace soon. Now, I also like to talk about the other question. Who is the FARC, and why do I keep referring to them as something that probably sounds like the word fart through the radio? Well, that's actually just about as long of a piece as the last one, so I'm going to play some more music and then come back on the history of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. And so I'm going to play, let's see. Could play Schoolboy Q or could play Aerosmith. And considering there's old people listening, no, I'm going to play Schoolboy Q.
Conversate with the fake. that part. All my b****s independent, that part. I just want the paper, that part. All my flavor, that part, that part, that part, that part. Hey.
It's impossible to love it if you don't come from it. It's things that goes on, you just can't stomach. I seen it all happen, but I ain't saying nothing. Peep, 24-7 in the hood is high. If you wanna fall through, get top on the phone. He don't pick up, then it ain't boo. Let you know it ain't good to stop.
That part, that part,
that part.
I'm a watch, and we not kosher. Only concern is the bottom line, like a stockholder. This is where they come, where they cop in boulders. Cat fight with they exposed. Still sipping on that wild Irish rose. Still rock swap me designer clothes. Ah, black in my mattress. Make 100 racks do a backflip. Might go Uncle Luke on them, on them. Pop pop for a bankroll.
Yeah.
All my with me got a blank face.
Yeah.
On that you where the pay pay. Make them pull up on your block with them two two. Pay me that your face, hey. Moving with the rock and the concealers. You either selling rock or you flock to get it. You either on the watch while the clock is ticking. The life of my watch and my bomb to get pinched, I'ma post the bond. No P.O.P., go hold it down. Look, need cash, gotta get you some. If a hater tell you money ain't everything, he don't want you to get none. So we thugging like DMX, bleed PMS, point blank, period. Meet me on the ES, I'm fully with the BS, believe that.
And we don't stress, a 38 till it free your chest. And PP on the PO's desk, I'm Jay-Z in a blowout press. Relate me to your blowout's best, can hate me or remote your death. From HD, causing photo theft, my AC, and he freeze, gotta hold your breath. From 8 feet, when I hold his tech, protect me from the local threats. My ID, say my eye don't rest, my IV, qualified T-Rex society. Kept my IQ vexed, denying me from my Ivy school. Applying me to the street, I slept, I quietly had the hole is tool, reminding me of the black I rep, the turf I step, the church and the earth I bless. The first I guessed alert was the murk I chef. That hurts to flirt with perks of a confess, disperse the worst. The first 48 address the search and loss of verse of the birth I nest. The awe, the curse of a pose and sense, the good, the flaws, the pain to reverse what's left.
Me no converse with the fake, that part. All my b****s independent, that part. I just want the paper, that part. All my flavor, that part, that part, that part, that part. Hey,
Seska, 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 Seska. Lamborghini high, cream soda with the white card. Solo profit, yeah, solo profit. That's a fortune teller making withdrawals and deposits. Ironic, they wanna know where I've been in, where the f I been hiding in. When the f am I dropping that new work that take them to church and turn the universe upside down again? Since you're so smart, I can't get in my groove till we get the cue first.
Do thou will, not ye. My pool of thought is large enough to port the Red Sea. Father, forgive them, for they know not, know who they see. I got all eyes on me, call me 3-Pac.
Solo. Hang on, let me get some. Hang on, hang on.
Met a meal and I spent it in the same day. Got a but not that. Getting money on a vacay. Go-go gadgets in the driveway. Creamy Tony in July 8th. Yeah, I'm killing kitties on a Sunday. How you ballin' in the Hyundai? My Ferrari got a toupee. Swerve in a big body. Your favorite artist, I'm his big homie. Yeah, I'm walking with a fifth and I ain't voting. I'm a crip, homie. I'm with a bloods, with a low at. With a blood, with a choke. Brown gloves full of combat. How the fans in your contacts. How the fans know my set name. Flynn and the Moussain. How I dread of the rap game. Her solo coming up next. Since I got a class. Hers, they just got it mastered. The fire through the plastic, so fingers to the badges. They don't love you till the racks evolve. When I was broke, that wouldn't accept the call. Now they owe me for my decimals. Blank faces, gotta X them off. Enemies, gotta bob and weave. Gang banging like we stand for something. We're out to Sterling getting killed for nothing. Two cowards in the car, they just there to film. Saying Black Lives Matter, should've died with him. Wrong in your hood, you gon' ride on him. White with a badge, you gon' let that slide. Tell me how they sent that footage off and slept that night. I feel bad that my daughter gotta live this life. I'll die for my daughter, gotta fight this fight. Put a blank face on.
And the Black Hippie remix of that song is incredibly more intelligent than the actual version. I know that's hard to believe. Anyway, right before the break, I said that I was talking about the failed peace agreement in Colombia and between the FARC rebels and the Colombian government. What I didn't tell you is who is the FARC or the FARC. It's an acronym in Spanish. At least in Spanish, that's what it forms. So the FARC, they are known as the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. And they are Colombia's largest rebel group. In fact, you may have even seen their leader wonderfully dramatized in the most recent season of Narcos. Anyway, give them a little history. In 1964, the FARC was founded as the armed wing of the Communist Party. They follow a Marxist-Leninist ideology, meaning that they support the idea of a central democracy being used to support the communist state eventually. So it is actually like a little bit more watered down than like Stalinist communism, but that's for another talk. They were founded by small farmers who rose up against the large landowners in Colombia. These landowners had propagated an insurmountable amount of inequality in Colombia at the time. They have always been a guerrilla-style organization, and they have, at the time, 6,000 to 7,000 fighters, although just as recently as 14 years ago, they had 20,000 fighters. They operate in a small guerrilla groups, which are controlled by the governing body of the organization called the Secretariat. The group was founded in a time of far right-wing rule after large parcels of land had been sold to pay debts in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Inspired by the Cubans, they demanded more rights, but they were seen as a threat by the landowners, and their commune was disbanded. Originally, this commune actually existed in the central part of Colombia, ironically, because I remember, if you think back to the first piece, it was a central part of Colombia that voted no to the peace deal. Before the FARC, Colombia was in a time known as La Violencia, where between 200,000 and 300,000 people were killed after the liberal presidential candidate was assassinated right in the 40s, right after World War II. Clashes and riots turned into civil war, and the rest is history. As of lately, they have clashed the most with Colombian security forces and have done things such as, you know, destroying oil pipelines, electricity pylons, and even blowing up bridges. One of their favorite things to do is they often kidnap for ransom, frequently targeting military personnel and police. Many believe they play a role in the drug trade, or rather they tax those that are part of the drug trade. You know, I said they're in the rural areas, that's where these labs are to make, you know, I get cocaine, fine. But instead of just being a direct part of the cocaine trade, they've actually like taxed the routes these trucks move on and things like that. You know, they're essentially just like, if you're going to move through art, what they quote is their land, and they're going to tag it. Pretty clever. Additionally, the group is believed to have swaths of cash they've built up over time. These swaths of cash, they don't really know where they came from. There's obviously conspiracies out there that at one point the cash was given to them by certain Western governments. And then there's also belief that they've made it over the time of the taxing, the drug money, and it's just been a group since the 1960s, so they've had plenty of time to accumulate American dollars, actually. Now, it's not Colombian dollars. They have a lot of American dollars, which has quite a bit of purchasing power down there. So why the peace now? Well, security forces, like I said, have hit them hard over the last 10 years, and many of their leaders were either killed in combat or died of natural causes. It truly seems the movement is just dying out as Colombia becomes more democratic. The shift to democracy is what killed this group. You know, as regular citizens quickly figured out that communism is as inefficient as the far right wing government the FARC was intended to fight in the first place. So, you know, you get the idea that, you know, okay, so they didn't have enough representation, they didn't have enough rights. So the far left wing version of that, as opposed to being, you know, commanded by all these wealthy landowners, the wealthy elite control the society. They wanted the idea of everything's for the people, so that's the far left-wing version. Well, that's very inefficient, too. So as democracy and, you know, Western governments started to propagate democracy into these countries, they certainly figured out that, okay, we, you know, the normal man, you know, is like, okay, no, I'll vote for my leaders. Thank you. I'm not going to have all my money redistributed to everyone and work for the state. Anyway. So I certainly hope you've enjoyed this. You know, the last 2 weeks, I haven't really been focused around these historical type pieces. They're actually one of my more favorite things to talk about because it's, you know, it's a buried news story that has a lot of history. And just now we're starting to see the conclusion of that history. You know, this is a group that's been going around. It's been around since 1964. And now we see the conclusion, I mean, the conclusion again of more communism, you know, so we've slowly but surely seen the dissolution of communism. We've seen Cuba fall out of communism slowly but surely. You know, they're opening up trade with the West and things like that. That will only eventually, you know, once you break the trade barriers down, communism quickly goes away because quality consumer goods get into the market. But like I said, I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope to bring more stories like this to you in the future. Hopefully when they reach a peace agreement, which is expected to be pretty soon, I'll get to report that they did reach one. And so I'm going to play a little bit of music. I am going to play Aerosmith this time. And when I come back, we'll get back to domestic news, talk about a cool little story about the Manhattan housing market I found this week. So anyway, I will see you all in a few. double fade out there, since that song fades out as well. What's up, K-Chix listeners? Anyway, this is once again the Elephant in the Room with yours truly, Chris Roberts, and it is Thursday, October 6th, only because I need to put more timestamps in my podcast. Anyway, so right before the break, I said that we were going to talk about the trouble in the Manhattan housing market, because that is extremely relevant to everybody down here. But it's an interesting story, because it's quite a few big numbers in this story. So sales of previously owned condominiums and townhomes in Manhattan fell 20% compared to this time last year. There were 5,290 residents for sale, according to Bloomberg, which is 53% more than in September of 2013. So this all began when a new $1 million plus development began on the island, which caused high demand for existing properties under $1 million. Owners began to sell these sub $1 million properties at very high rates in the hopes of cashing out at the higher values that the new existing development was driving. You know, the new development was driving the existing development prices higher. So unfortunately, the higher selling prices have created a bit of a supply glut of houses on the market, and those who want to sell can't at current levels. Additionally, only 17% of buyers in Manhattan pay at or above the listing price, down from 31% just last year. So, I mean, it's not surprising that a low percentage of people pay at or above the listing price, especially in a place like Manhattan. 17% is actually really high compared to the rest of the nation. Now, that 31% is actually the average for Manhattan because of the high demand for the market. Prices have grown only 2.6% in the last quarter. That's a problem when the annual price growth of the last 3 years was once 18%, meaning that prices were growing in a quarter over the last 3 years at one point at a rate of 18%. From Bloomberg, quote, "There used to be a lot of fighting for very few apartments, but now there are plenty of choices," said Pamela Liebman, chief executive officer of the brokerage group Corcoran. Which is, if you know Barbara Corcoran, that's her group, which also released a report on the Manhattan market Tuesday. They said, "We're experiencing a certain level of disconnect now between what buyers are willing to bid and what sellers are willing to sell for, a.k.a. supply gut." Corcoran reported a 17% decline in completed apartment sales, with 3,418 homes trading hands in the third quarter. Contracts fell 18% to 2,589, the lowest in almost 5 years, indicating that sales will continue to be down. Corcoran continued by saying that the market simply can't keep going up, up, up forever. I won't lie, I get a certain bit of pride in my gut, however, when the most elite in the United States are victims of the housing market. Homes are one of the few items in the market that line up with the basic economic theories of supply and demand precisely. What I mean here is that there aren't many lags in the housing market, and prices tend to adjust rather quickly in market fluctuations, because when you're selling such a valuable asset with so many others like it, you have to adjust prices quickly if you want your property to stay competitive. And so, I mean, like I said, this isn't super relative to us or anything really, but, you know, it gives you an idea that, you know, we've had a big housing boom in this country since the recession. There's no denying that prices were super low during the recession, obviously, because it was a housing crisis. And so now they've climbed up, up, up. So this is just, you know, the peaks and troughs cycle. But the one thing to note about this is it's good to look at markets like Manhattan because of that supply and demand effect, because all those properties are worth millions or right at a million. You know, they have to adjust quickly. And what this tells us, then, is that the housing market could very well be contracting a lot faster than maybe other people had predicted. So, you know, yes, we see peaks and troughs in the housing market, but they're very gradual. Because everything adjusts so quickly, they're very gradual changes overall. And if you look at the chart on the long term, their changes, they don't happen very fast. But now we've had extremely fast changes. And this isn't the only market. The Manhattan market isn't the only, you know, high-dollar market that's seen this. A lot of California markets have seen hyper-expansion and then hyper-contraction of prices, which is just, of course, right in line with the rest of the economy right now, which is just extremely volatile in every way whatsoever. All right. Well, I hope you all enjoyed that little piece there. Key here is now, you know, we have a lot of new development happening, especially in cities, you know, like where I'm from, Houston, where there's, you know, a whole wide range of people, or just normal cities in general. You know, you have a lot of new development, a lot of new suburbs, because people since the recession, regular people, were priced out of the market that already existed. The houses already existed. They were already in the recession. They didn't have the money to buy them then because it was a financial crisis. And now, because prices have recovered since the financial crisis, they can't buy them now. So they're looking at new development. You got people living outside the city more. You know, so a good measure of what the future of the housing market holds is in really, really rich markets, because they're able to adjust quickly because they're so you know, homogeneous in their nature. You know, all these properties are the same. They have very high prices, et cetera, et cetera. I've already explained this. But so anyway, I'm going to play a little bit more music. Got another EDM track coming up. This one I really dig. It's like the first, like, you know, if you're into this stuff and you're listening, excuse me, this song's like 40 seconds of just like, I don't know what I'm really listening to. And then just that drop, bro, that drop. Anyway, so I'm going to come back. We're talking about the VP debate. That'll be the last story for today. Anyway, listen to this song. I hope you enjoy it. See you in a few. What's up, KHX listeners? I hope you enjoyed that chill piece of music right there. And so anyway, right before the break, said you'll get them out of me. You'll get my comments on the VP debate. So let's get down to business. Surprisingly, the VP debate was just about as entertaining as the regular debate. both candidates squared off well, but it looks like, at least from the post-debate polls, that Mike Pence actually won this one. I'll be honest, it truly sounded like Tim Kaine was a bit of an anti-Trump soapbox that was pre-programmed with one-line zingers. Kaine would not answer the questions. It would immediately revert back to Trump and or Mike Pence. You know, I mean, it just wouldn't answer the questions. The attack dog format does not suit Tim Kaine. And what I mean by that is your vice president is supposed to be your attack dog. You're supposed to be the guy who's going to go out there and attack the other candidate. Neither of these candidates do that. But the American people were looking for Tim Kaine to prove why his candidate's policy is better. Instead, we get an ultra-defensive Mike Pence and a Chihuahua attack dog in Tim Kaine. Kaine continually what I mean by Chihuahua is that, you know, he wasn't very scary. Kaine continually interrupted his opponent, and Pence seemed much more poised, and, you know, honestly, compared to Trump the week before. Remember that the last debate, Trump spent a lot of his time interrupting, and we saw where that got him. Granted, he didn't have much time, much to offer the American people other than to interrupt. So now I'm down to the recap. Taxes. Well, oh boy, I think this is where Tim Kaine messed up. To equate Donald Trump using the tax code that they as politicians put into place with him not supporting the country and being un-American is absurd. I mean, the soldier comment, I mean, that just kind of pissed me off, to be completely honest with you. I feel like he was really reaching for strings. You know, following the law of the land and using it to maintain profit is not un-American. It's the most un-American thing you can do. Furthermore, this is a man that adds enough money to the U.S. economy that he was able to have a $900 million loss 21 years ago. It's clear he's doing quite well today, so I don't think you can equate this with unsavvy business practices. You know, many billionaires and multimillionaires in this country have already said that they wouldn't mind paying more on the bottom line income. 20 or 30% doesn't make much, 20 versus 30% doesn't make much difference in their buying power. I mean, you can only eat so much caviar, you can only eat so much lobster, and that's what people don't realize. They just think, oh, the rich just want to get richer. Well, there's a point, and you can look at people like Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, the really, really rich people in this world. Don't give two craps what their effective tax rate is anymore. You can take as much money as you want. Now, granted, I mean, 100% would be an invaluable, or 80 or 60, but you can take a reasonable amount of money and their lifestyle is not going to change. Okay, they don't get the gold-plated jet, they get the aluminum jet. You know, it's like, they don't care. If you really think they care, then you haven't studied economics or rich people enough. So, on to foreign policy. You know, I think Pence had a tougher time here defending the actions of the last administration. But he did do an excellent job of highlighting the inefficiencies of the Hillary Clinton State Department. Believe it or not, and what I mean by the last administration, I think I meant the Bush administration. Pence could not defend the Bush administration, but he did do an excellent job of highlighting Hillary Clinton's problems. Believe it or not, Pence actually attacked she and Obama's policy in the Middle East, and not the fact that she had an email server. On the other side, I thought that Kaine did an excellent job in highlighting Trump's gaffes with Putin, although with Putin and other world leaders. Although Pence did field criticism well by changing the subject to America, to an America versus Russia themed argument. So it has been, you know, they're really good friends, you know, Putin and Trump. So Pence did an excellent job of saying, no, we are theming an American versus Russia theme, you know, an argument. So Kaine also shined when he talked about Trump's insult, especially to McCain. Both of those men have children that are servicemen, and Trump's comments about McCain not being a war hero because he was a POW or Camp R, like I said earlier, they're perfect zinger. Overall, though, I mean, Pence fielded the criticism better. His demeanor was better, and because he didn't sound like a pre-programmed robot, his content was better. I mean, look, we're at an even one-on-one debates now. You can value the presidential debates more, but a lot of people watch that VP debate. 85 million TVs turned on to the presidential. I think it was close to 70, right at 70 million for that debate right there. That's quite a few people. I hope for America's sake that Donald has something real to offer Americans this Sunday, because he can build off of Pence's performance here. If he can get some policy integration on the board, he can win this next debate, and he must keep his demeanor more than anything. Honestly, he needs to spend more time with his running mate and start taking whatever he's taking. You know, I mean, there's something. Mike Pence showed that the Trump administration, quote-unquote, or what could be, does have somebody in its realms that knows policy. You know, Mike Pence, he knew about Middle Eastern policy. You know, he highlighted areas in which Donald Trump was useless, essentially. And so when Donald Trump says, I pick the best people. I do this. You can see the argument he's trying to make. You know, he's trying to say, well, now, you know, people are saying he's mad at Pence for doing a better job than him. No. He can come out now and say, look, I do pick the best people. Look how good Mike Pence is. Look how much he knew about this. Look at the state he comes from. You know, that's the kind of stuff he needs to be doing. And so I'm really curious to see what happens. I'm more excited for the second debate than the first. I knew the first was going to be a crapshoot. I knew it was going to be, you know, wrong, you know, and the sniffling and the utter stupidity by Donald in general. You know, I fully expect him to do better this week because Mike Pence did better. They now have an argument. They know how to attack. They know how to get under Tim Kaine's skin. And so hopefully that's going to work, in at least for them, if they think this, you know, and it's going to work in getting under Hillary's skin, which is really key to the debate. I think that's what he tried to do last time, but he was, you know, Trump lost energy. He didn't have his facts lined up. Really hope he goes into this next debate as prepared as Mike Pence did. He knew the points he was going to attack him on. He knew he was going to attack him on taxes. He knew he was going to attack him on Putin. He knew, you know, and then, you know, the social things, the things like, you know, the women comments, that, at the end of the day, I don't think that really boils down to the average American voter. I really don't. Especially your average Republican voter who truly, that's who Trump's trying to get out, because now he's having a turnout problem with Republicans. So anyway, those were my thoughts on the VP debate. You know, it wasn't, you know, I did say it was just as exciting. It wasn't, you know, filled with, you know, oh my Jesus moments, but, you know, overall, good debate. Anyway, so I'll play a little Weezer here and hop off the air. I want to thank everybody for listening to the show once again. I am getting the podcast up at a good rate now. We got the new podcast system working. So once again, thanks everybody. Thanks everybody for listening. Happy birthday, Cole. And here's a little Weezer for you guys to send you off.
The girl in the pastry shop with the net in her hair is making a cannoli for you to take on your hiking trip in the woods with your bros that you've known since second grade. And your main kind of dragons are ruffians and be called upon to employ your testosterone in a